So today we have Memoir from the Middle of Things with Zach Savage. Zach is the author of 6 books of poetry, including most recently Daybed, which Publishers Weekly says, quote, crafts vibrant images of the natural world and stirring reinterpretations of the everyday. These poems are an effective balm against the rigid narratives and literalism of the real world. He is also the author of 2 books of prose, including Diving Makes the Water Deep, a memoir about cancer, teaching, and poetic friendship. A graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, he now teaches in the undergraduate creative writing program at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia and co-edits Rescue Press's Open Prose series. Today, Zach will be presenting Memoir from the Middle of Things, which explores how to approach writing about events that are still unfolding. Please join me in welcoming Zach Savage.
Cool, thank you. I think it's on. On, Mike, hi. It's really good to see you all. Thanks for being here. Thanks, Rachel, and everyone for organizing. I love this lecture series. I love the spirit of it. If some of you have been here in past years, you know it's a chance to come out of the workshops or come back if you're not in a workshop right now and hear some ideas that then come back through the day. So I'm really grateful to get to kick it off. If you've seen me do this kind of thing before, you know I have one rhetorical move, which is to prepare very well, and then it's like at the wedding where you're about to give a toast and the person rips up their notes and they speak off the cuff. I'm not going to do that today. I'm going to read my remarks with the hope that that then will allow more time for some conversation at the end. So this lecture looks at the question of how you can write memoir about things that are still happening, things you're still in the middle of, especially when you don't know how they'll turn out, and especially when they're changing how you think and feel about things like who you are, what time is, what memory is, what the future might be. How can you write about these experiences when they seem to defy telling a tidy story, a story shaped into a beginning, middle, and end, especially if you want to capture some of that extremity, uncertainty, and flux? Some of you might be having the reaction already that people have when I say I'm interested in this topic, how to write about things you're still in the middle of. I say we're going to write about things we're still in the middle of. You might say, isn't that everything? Isn't that all of life until the end? Middle. We talked about this a year ago in a class I taught here on this topic. Janie was there. I don't know if anyone else. It was a great group. One thing that came out as we talked about writing about things you're in the middle of, the illustrations align adjacently with the text. As we talked about writing things in the middle of, most people in the room were writing memoir that incorporated techniques from other genres. They're fictionalizing things. They're using moves that looked like poetry or script writing. They're using methods that seemed closer to processes of collage and collection from visual art. This is interesting, that there's something about writing from the middle that leads you away from creative nonfiction in a strict sense. So maybe one answer to this question, if we're always in the middle of things, for all of life, what does it mean to talk about writing in the middle of things? Is to try to access more of all of life than nonfiction might otherwise show. This could be particularly true in the midst of things that seem like you can't access yourself, can't access life or perception because of exhaustion or caretaking or commitment or limited hours or complex health, oppressive dynamics, attention or cognitive ability altering. And maybe in those times, it's when that seam between nonfiction and other forms can become most porous and is what we should move through. So I'm not going to focus on that in this lecture, on memoir that borrows from other genres. But I do want to look at one passage that does just that. That brings the engines of poetry and fiction to bear on nonfictional content. This is a short passage from Karen Balin's wonderful, thrilling book of anti-travel writing, Travel Writing Spain. Please go find it. What a good cover. I won't go into it too much, but you'll see how Balin's writing refuses a lot of the conventional advice about making writing interesting in order to get at an interesting quality of experience. Here's what I mean. This is from near the beginning. It's formatted like a poem, but it looks more like prose on the page. A sheep is like sheep. I stayed until dark. I watched the sheep like living mutton. They milled in circles under olive trees for shade at the siesta, the grass graying down, a green undoing on the sloping plain in the dusk like a black perfume, the smell of a fetid swan being spritzed in Spain. Darkness, then blackness, like oil. I was up a hill. The black air is more than a darkness. A white sheep was dipped in black oil from a harness. We could talk about this for a while. You could also, if you're not sure what to write next, try this style. You see how this seems to at once deny the tenets of an exacting, realistic prose style, of a vivid style, while also rendering a scene in a way that becomes uniquely vivid. It moves into its own language and into seeing in a way that seems closer to poetry than to the newspapers I read, at least. So my plan is to tell you how I got interested in this topic, to look at examples from a few writers, and look at techniques that we could extract that I hope are useful for whatever you're writing, and then to talk a little bit about a memoir I wrote a few years ago, and then we'll take the conversation where you like. So how did I get into this? As some of you here know, I'm a person who's dealt with cancer and recovery from cancer and more cancer during the last years. This is just starting to feel like the past, or like I can think about a future 6 months on that won't be defined by that spinning coin. I'm very glad to be with you all now in this state. But for anyone here who is in the middle of something like that, and maybe it's not always apparent when people meet you, but it's defining every moment, I spent some years like that too, and we could talk about that more. There are books that helped me during that time, memoirs from the middle. Here's one that maybe some of you know. Journals, we talk about journals and diaries. Audre Lorde's Cancer Journals was one, a classic. As you all know, illness puts you in a lot of narrative situations. You gotta tell your doctor what's happening. You gotta talk to the insurance company. You have to tell people you work with, family, friends. You can say a word like cancer, that non-fictional word, and people get an idea. But that idea is very different from the daily experience, the things that I would hope a memoir would lead us further into. From the texture of days, from the how the mind works differently, drugged, disoriented by generalized toxicity, by the fear of death or the fact of death, which our culture can make feel shameful, unutterable. You're supposed to have a story of triumph. So there's a gap between the readily available language, I had cancer, and the experience. Even for two people with the same kind, and in addition to telling your story to a lot of people in that kind of state, you need to tell your story to yourself. In days in which the main task of every day can feel like just getting through a day, when you don't need the day to be tellable or narratable, but survivable, there's little to it but an ongoing sense of middles. This isn't true only about illness. It can apply to almost any experience of extremity or maybe any experience at all. Should we write a memoir about our marriage? I'm married, I love my wife. But that's not marriage. That story, that line isn't marriage. I love my wife sounds clear, but that's actually what could be more complicated, what could take more of every life of all of life to figure. So when I'm talking about memoir in the middle of things, maybe I am talking about all of life, but about viewing all of life in parts, not just burying our heads in the sand of story, but looking around, like at that moment after something has happened when you don't yet know the story you'll tell about it. Could we stay in that moment? And in those stammers and in those false starts, start to see something further. One issue that I was hearing sprinkling through here has to do with causation cause and effect, which is an engine of so many, if we scarecrow a trite traditional memoir in some way, that easily lines up, this led to that. I acted that way because that thing happened to me once, or I have that belief, and thus I deduce that I should behave this way, and my life followed suit. What I'm hearing from these examples is something about defying or complicating causation. One thing doesn't lead to another in that easy way that you could tell a story about to someone who wants things wrapped up, or wants things neutralized almost by narrative so they can understand and not have to be still in the midst of figuring out the problem. So thinking about causation, a book I love, this is a book about addiction and recovery. Michael Clune is the name, Whiteout. He has two passages in this book that think about causation or causality in some ways that can be useful. In the first one, he's satirizing a way that people can use cause to rationalize anything. So this is about, he's in a meeting here with addicts. He's saying, I'm Mike and I'm an addict, said the other Mike. He was a bright, confident looking man in his late 30s. What brought me here, he said, was 9/11. 9/11 hit me pretty hard too. I don't live in New York, but I identify. That's someone else. I don't work in New York, says someone else, either, but it's like after 9/11, I just wasn't the same person. Inside, I mean. I'm Al, and I'm an addict. I'm here just simply because I messed up and started smoking that damn cane, but I want to say to Mike on 9/11, I feel you, bro. So everyone in this room agrees that September 11th, of course, has led to everything it's led to, but for people telling their stories in this moment, it's the cause for everyone. When, of course, we know addiction doesn't often have a single cause, right? It's a complicated part of people's lives. People who need a story to tell can shape anything into a story that lines up with a cause, to choose one thing and say it extend from that. I'm curious about what happens when causes and effects are less distinct. Here's another passage from this book. Cause is different here. Mrs. Nichols dies when I'm 6. I look at the sky. The phone rings when I'm 25, lying on my bed, alternately sick from dope and sick from no dope. Why did these things happen? What caused them? Did Mrs. Nichols' death cause me to look up at the sky when I was 6? Did my odd habit of staring at the sky when I was a kid cause me to become a junkie? And then, lying sick from bad dope, did my hate at that goddamn ringing telephone drop down through the past and kill Mrs. Nichols? This shows a memoir in the middle of things, relationship to time. Clune is still in the middle of all these events. They aren't causing one another, but they're causing connections. They put him in the middle of that web of connections, rather than putting him at the end, having arrived, gone through it all. All right, so I'm interested in this topic because I'm generally skeptical about stories that tell us mostly about the stories we mostly tell. Around illness, we tell this one kind of story, around marriage, another. By focusing memoir in the middle, we stay in these hard waters, not swimming for resolution. I'm interested in stories we can't move on from, the ones that you could say are in the middle of us. So let's look at some examples, try some techniques. This all comes out of the class that we did at the festival a year ago. The first, I want to look at some passages from Laura Hillenbrand. You might know her, author of Seabiscuit. This is from an essay called A Sudden Illness from The New Yorker, 2003. The concept I want to look at through this, it has to do with time, representing time as a character or the body's relationship to time as a central event, not assuming how time or the body work. So this is an essay about living for many years with chronic fatigue syndrome. Typical narrative momentum is often about moving through time. In this passage, you see Hillenbrand moving into time, or showing time moving through her. Here's one passage. I was growing much stronger, but whenever I overextended myself, my health disintegrated. One mistake could land me in bed for weeks. So the potential cost of even the most trivial activities, from showering to walking to the mailbox, had to be painstakingly considered. Sometimes I relapsed for no reason at all. Living in perpetual fear of collapse was stressful, but on my good days, I was functioning much better. By 1990, I could walk all over Hyde Park, navigate the stairs of the apartment with ease, and for half an hour on one blissful afternoon, ride a horse. 3 years after becoming ill, I wrote to Link about the curious sensation of growing younger. I want to look at one more paragraph in the middle, but what are the things that strike you immediately about this one? Cause comes in. I relapse for no reason at all. There's a defying an easy cause. How frustrating that can be for a doctor to encounter. And she talks about all the people who misattributed her disease to other causes because of events like this. Are there things that stand out to you all about this passage, about how it depicts time or an experience of being in the middle of things? Yeah, her relationship to time becomes unmoored. I mean, it reminds me of this passage from Clune, where he has events from childhood and events from later mingling together. Time becomes a single time. The curious sensation of growing younger. And she means that, I take it, in several ways. One is about her relationship to the world, or her relationship to pleasure or ability, dependable ability, her reliance on others. All those things are wrapped up. And this is an essay in Janie, You Might Remember from last year. She's always signaling time. And I think you can read that as it's a narrator whose relationship to time has gotten unstuck in some ways. So she's continually grounding herself. That's such a, if you've read the further essay, you understand that by 1990 is a period of years. By 1990. But that's just that clause. I could walk all over Hyde Park and for half an hour on one blissful afternoon ride a horse. This seems like an anecdote, but it's an anecdote that's illustrating a habitual state about chronic continuity. So it's not a story that resolves things, but it's more like time is moving backwards, time is moving around. Here's another paragraph from this essay. It starts off with time again, time stamps us. For as long as 2 months at a time, I couldn't get down the stairs. Bathing became nearly impossible. Once a week or so, I sat on the edge of the tub and rubbed a washcloth over myself. The smallest exertion plunged me into a crash. First, my legs would weaken and I'd lose the strength to stand. Soon, I would lose the strength to speak. Only my eyes were capable of movement. At the bottom of each breath, I would wonder if I'd be able to draw the next one. So it does that thing I mentioned, starting with time markers, for as long as 2 months at a time, once a week or so. That could teach us something. If you're writing about a time where time feels unusual, anchoring time continually in the writing seems like a technique to try. This crash in quotes, that also seems instructive. To give a name to something, that's a stand-in. That word crash seems to communicate. You could nod and kind of get it. Oh, I'm crashing, I'm exhausted. But it's obviously standing in for a whole nexus of experience. This is movement away from action in a way, away from the action of plot, or into the action of the body's basic processes. She talks about breathing, difficulty breathing. Think about breathlessness in typical dramatic writing. It's often a response to big action or something you do before big action. Here, it's an ongoing state. The author can't assume that even breath will come. So these passages show a couple ways that memoir in the middle of things can emphasize time. Time is a character in itself. First, by showing actions that are habitual, that don't progress, but that circle around. And second, by focusing on bodily experience in a way that a lot of conventional narrative would ignore. You don't need to say that you're breathing. Here, time and the basics of the body become everything. Second principle of memoir in the middle of things I'd like to emphasize has to do with emotions, ones that, when you're in the middle of things, can seem to expand beyond an apparent cause. They can seem out of proportion with what would be a typical response. So this is from an essay by Tyler Boudreau called The Morally Injured. It extends from his experience as a Marine in Iraq. After leaving the military, he was diagnosed with PTSD. He says he'd been shot at and shelled enough to explain away his turbulent emotions, to have them swallowed up by that diagnosis. But he doesn't know if PTSD is the right term for what he's experiencing. he starts to explore this term moral injury, which at the time he wrote this essay was defined by the VA as coming from an act of transgression that creates dissonance and conflict because it violates assumptions and beliefs about right and wrong and personal goodness. So not just from a direct something you did, but from something that makes you question who you are or what is right and wrong or if you are a good person. This term, moral injury, sought not to depoliticize veterans' experiences into the individualized, medicalized diagnosis of PTSD, but to think more about shared experiences. It's not just about individual trauma. So here's a passage where he explores a response he has to seeing a film about Iraq. I was watching a documentary about Iraq with a friend of mine, not a veteran. Midway through the piece, a short video clip was shown of two soldiers searching an Iraqi home. The footage was uneventful, boring even, capturing nothing but a bit of walking around and some chit-chat between the Americans and the family. Then one of the soldiers, clad in body armor, sunglasses, and an automatic rifle, feeling in an amorous mood, I suppose, leaned toward a young Iraqi man in the living room and gave him a hug. The Iraqi submitted with limp arms and an unenthusiastic smile. The soldier, maybe 19 or 20 years old, laughed. The other soldier laughed too. That was it. The footage ended. I felt my face get hot with rage. I blurted out something in anger, something profane, to match the profanity of what had just been presented in this documentary without so much as a comment from the narrator. What, my friend asked, what's wrong? This passage shows a lot. That moment, that was it, is so intriguing. It's different than saying, really, here's the really important part. I'm going to convince you how important this event was. It undercuts it. It shows almost a reticence or an inability to go further. That was it. I can't explain more. You see that the language gets vague. Something in anger, something profane. What, my friend asked me, what's wrong? We're not getting content there. We're getting dynamics or gestures. This passage also doesn't focus on what Boudreau did or didn't do as a soldier, but his reaction comes from his experiences. It might not make sense in a traditional, plotted way to say that he did this or that, and that's why he feels a sense of moral dissonance in this scene. It's not as simple as that kind of cause and effect. Rather, his feelings feel wider than the catalyst. That was it blossoms. You know this can happen when things are intense. I remember once during a period of chemotherapy when I was on my way to treatment and I couldn't find a baseball cap that I liked, and as a last straw, can't I have just this one thing, just this Mount Rainier baseball cap all faded and torn? It's a writing exercise you could try. Take any event and don't ask where it ends up and don't ask what it means, but give it as a that was it moment and then show what balloons out from and around that moment. So not trying to see the idea directly, but to see around it. Don't react as you normally would in a social setting. I knock over my coffee, I'm fine. But explore the potentiality of extremity as a way to acknowledge how extreme things might actually be. In the essay, it's more interesting if I knock over the coffee and it ruins the world. And I show that position. This could seem like it starts to deny a forward narrative momentum, to linger and ruminate in what may be ruts. But that seems compelling. To show how a mind can circle back beyond reason, beyond story, the way that the past can cut in and bring you back to something that you thought you were over, that you thought that the story had moved past. Here's a passage from essayist Alicia Washuta that shows this dynamic. I feel like I should say I'm tired of writing this again. I'm always writing that Tomoth was hanged a year after signing the Kalapua Treaty. I'm always writing that his daughters were taken to Fort Vancouver when the Cascade leaders were hanged. I'm always writing about the resistance of the women who hung tough along the Columbia River for generations. Even after the disruption of the systems of hunting, fishing, and gathering our family maintained for thousands of years. Actually, I'm not tired of writing about this, and I may never be, but sometimes, when I say once more that my great-great-great-grandfather was hanged by the U.S. government, I can feel someone thinking, God, she's back on that again. I'm curious about the things that you feel tired of writing about, that you need to keep writing about in new ways. the things that it feels like it is, you have become its subject. You know, we could think, does the story of a life start after the point at which there's an event that you need to mention before telling that story? You know, this, what is that originary event? Not to solve, but to keep being with further. Again, I feel like I should say I'm tired of writing. This is not forward momentum, but it's digging in. If you want to read about this more, a book I love, Wounded Storyteller, Arthur W. Frank, he mentions, this is a sociologist of illness narratives, he describes a related effect. He says, in the lived chaos, there is no mediation. Storytelling would be a form of mediation, only immediacy. The body is imprisoned. We could think about that metaphor of prison. The body is in, do we feel comfortable with it? Does it match? The body is imprisoned in the frustrated needs of the moment. The person living the chaos story has no distance from her life and no reflective grasp on it. Lived chaos makes reflection and consequently storytelling impossible. I don't know if I agree with this totally. Washuta shows that we can return to and reflect on and relate impossibility. We can show how we become impossible. And Boudreau's reaction shows that immediacy can be something you can relate in a way that finds a shape. It might not be measured or plotted into artful proportion, but it can show the way that things are out of proportion. So I've tried to suggest that memoir in the middle of things can look at time as a character, can look at bodily experience as something to be explicit about, and also that showing reaction out of proportion can help reveal things that don't easily match into the proportions of received storytelling. The final thing I'd like to look at, final technique, is what I think of as a public health turn in memoir. What I mean by that, you know, it can be useful to think about social issues, the opioid crisis, incarceration, not as issues of individual grit or will or affliction, but as issues that connect to social systems, that connect to collective experience. In conventional memoirs, there can be an overemphasis on the individual, how they suffer, they learn lessons. But in my experience, most things I'd wish to write about are the things that have become most collective, are the experiences that have changed my relationships, that have made me rely on others, that have implicated me into social systems in ways that complicate my understanding of myself and the world. I'd like memoirs that show that way that the self can be multiple and reliant on others or composed by its interactions. So what would it look like to write like that? Especially if you're in a state where the self feels multiple or variable, where you feel challenged by to have a consistent persona. This is a book of poems that might be better than any other I know for this. Juliana Spahr, This Connection of Everyone with Lungs. It's a book that tries to, when you read the newspaper, there's so much happening. You receive that fragmentation discreetly. Now I'm on the business page, now I'm on the sports. But you know that it's all happening at once. It's all happening simultaneously. How could you try to attend to that simultaneity? Everything happening just in Iowa City right now, to try to hold that in mind, knowing that it's impossible. It's good to think of with Walt Whitman's Bicentennial, because he does it too. You'll get a sense of the style of this book here. While we turned sleeping uneasily, a warehouse of food aid was destroyed, stocks on upbeat sales soared, Australia threatened first strike, there was heavy gunfire in the city of man, the Belarus ambassador to Japan went missing, a cruise ship caught fire, on yet another cruise ship many got sick, and the Pope made a statement against xenophobia. While we turned sleeping uneasily, perhaps J-Lo gave Ben a prenuptial demand for sex 4 times a week. You can guess when this was written from some of these references. First, it's a we. You know, and Spahr is someone who's written other autobiography in the collective voice, in the sense of a self defined by friends and relationships. It's a we that starts off sleeping. There's the body, there's time, and then tries to catalog or preserve all the other things that might be happening at that moment. This is a mode taken from the epic. If you want to learn more, if you feel like coming back on Wednesday, I'm going to talk about peace. And we'll talk about some passages like this a little bit more. Where I'd like to go is to review. I hope this is suggestion more than persuasion. Here are several ideas that I talked about. Memoir in the middle of things. Some stuff maybe that you could try. Using techniques from poetry, fiction, and other arts. Treating time itself as a character, showing the body in time, attending to that, not assuming that the self is a mobile modular that you can move around. Showing reactions, ruts, and refrains, especially when they're out of proportion to what seems to be a cause. That was just it. And then making the self multiple, collective, variable, porous, having the self spread out into the world and be defined by the states it can share with others, or the ways it can become a tuning fork to, in Spar's case, things in the news. So let's pretend. Let's pretend we had a little more time. And if we had a little more time, I would say, does this work? And I'd ask you to go back to your idea that you're writing about, your topic, and try out some of these things, and we'd share some of those. Think about ways that you have attempted it. Let's, for the sake of time, let's do that in our minds. Let's do that. We'll press pause, and you can drift in your mind wherever you like for as long as you can, and then we'll snap back here. I'm curious about this. I'm curious what you think, especially if you're someone who's writing a piece like this now. Does this work? But I want to take a minute to try to embed these ideas in my own work as a writer, and maybe that will clarify or give a different angle on things. I'd like to do that by reading just briefly from this book that came out a few years ago. This is, as Rachel mentioned, a book about experiences with cancer, friendship. It does the collective thing, about half of it in the end. It comes from other people, from correspondence, from quotation, from friends who I wrote when I myself was unable to write and I had them pitch in. It's a book written on the brink of a diagnosis or a diagnosis for recurrence. And my thought at the time was, there's a book that any of us could write at such a brink when you understand that you'll soon enter a state where you will not be able to write, maybe forever, maybe for a short time. And you don't have time to get it all right. You can't become an expert. You can't become a diligent researcher and figure out the best way to say things. You know that you're going to get some stuff wrong. You're going to say some things in a way that is based in the moment. But that's what time is. So one thing I tried to do with this, I'll just read from the beginning where you hear this, is write about time itself. Write about time. If I was starting to feel removed, I was gaining a social role that was more in reality of a sick person. That was defining my relationships and routines. In that state, how to write about that self that's changing, or an absence of self, and a sense of an absence of time, or of time's suppleness. It's in small sections, you'll hear that they're fragments. They kind of start in the middle. That the poems I wrote before I first had cancer would not sound right at my memorial. That the poems I wrote after I first had cancer would not sound right anywhere else. That I have not talked with my students about the various ways of reading poems at memorials, who will. That graceful is any hand to the extent that the sun. Self-elegy is a critical term I just learned, don't have time to learn about it. That when I first had cancer, at 30, 3 months after my father died at 60 from the same cancer, I thought of these lines from the poet Larry Levis. Levis writes, "The last thing my father did for me was map a way. He died and so made death possible. If he could do it, I will also someday be so honored." I started saying it without the final phrase, preferring to end on someday. If he could do it, I will also someday. In the rooms of explicit examination this week, I felt the passage is beautiful but hardly true. The last thing my father did for me was die, and so took care of that. I can focus elsewhere. Much as he knew the name of any tree so I could simply look. Paper, covering, the elevated examination bed, too thin to write on. It's a part of the body. You could take it between your fingers. Go ahead. I feel, reading this now a few years on, that sense of I'm tired of writing about it. I'm tired of this being my topic. It's one that I've had to rehearse too much. But I also feel responsible to that inescapability. That's a problem for my own being in the middle of it. How to write going forward after years that were defined by this topic in while also going forward from this topic. Thank you very much. Have a great day.